New U.S. Census figures show the Philadelphia region yields its title of sixth most populous metro area to Washington, D.C. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the Philadelphia region is still growing, but its gains are slow compared with other big cities.
Experts say there's one main reason behind Philadelphia's drop from sixth most populated metro area to seventh in just 1 year. We're not replacing people fast enough.
It's going to continue to slip because, again, nationally, the population growth is shifting south and west.
Rutgers University demographer James Hughes says lots of immigrants are moving to the Philly area and young people are coming in droves, but it's still not enough to offset the exodus. People with families in particular are moving south and west for jobs and milder winters.
Young millennials, childless millennials, single millennials are still flocking to the city. And, you know, when children come along, some tough decisions have to be made on where to locate.
New York, LA, and Chicago remain the country's top three population centers. But the real story is in Texas. Four metros there collectively added almost 500,000 people. The census even called its report, Texas Keeps Getting Bigger. In Philly, meanwhile, the metro area's population has grown over the past 9 years. But in context, it's not that much. As the new census figures show, Philly added 16,000 residents in the last year. And what did D.C. add? More than 63,000. Should Philly be concerned about this? Demographer Hughes.
Not really, because there's not much you can do about it. But basically, Washington is driven by federal government spending.
If the current trend continues, metro areas in Atlanta and Miami will surpass Philadelphia's in 5 years. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Philadelphia has come under fire in recent years for its failure to collect delinquent taxes. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports that the city's revenue department says it needs an extra $4 million to help fix that problem.
About half that money would help ensure distributors pay Mayor Jim Kenney's proposed sugary drinks tax, if it passes. The other half would expand efforts made in recent years to get delinquent taxpayers to, well, pay up. Revenue Commissioner Frank Breslin wants to double the amount of notices the department sends out.
One of the things we're looking at is what language works best and what kind of things in bills and notices really motivates people to pay. And as we study that, though, one of the things that we find is that just noticing people more frequently is effective.
The department also wants to pay for more lawyers to take legal action against tax delinquents. Breslin's hoping for a good return on the investment. The department estimates it can rake in about $70 million over the next 5 years as a result of these efforts. Whether it gets that money to do that will be up to City Council. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
In a change of heart, Pennsylvania Republican U.S. Senator Pat Toomey says courtesy and respect are motivating him to meet with President Barack Obama's Supreme Court Justice nominee, Merrick Garland. Let's honor our weekly meeting with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, a change of heart, but not a change of mind. Toomey says the high court vacancy should not be filled until after the November election. Does that jive with what the public wants?
No, it doesn't. Most polling that I've seen says that Americans think the Senate should go ahead and consider Merrick Garland. What we did is we ask a different question where we simply say, would you want the Senate to vote in favor or against Garland as the nominee? And the way we ask it is very similar to how we've asked all the other nominees in recent years. 52% of Americans say yes to that basic question. And that means a slight majority say yes, they think that the Senate should say yes to him. And that's about where we have found for other nominees. For example, Elena Kagan, who was also nominated by Obama, 46% said yes in the same question. Sonia Sotomayor was 54%. We did ask, Dave, those who said no, if it was because they didn't like him personally, that is, he's too liberal or what have you, or too conservative if you're a liberal. Or is it because they thought the next president should make the nomination and not the current one? And when we asked that question, the majority of people who said no, so it was because they wanted the next president to make the nomination.
Frank, let's turn to the Brussels terrorist attacks. And first off, I have a sense that when these horrible events happen, there's this huge spike of reaction to it, and then it seems to die off in the American public.
We don't have any new polling since the attacks this week, but what you said is correct, particularly in terms of our open-ended question, what's the most important problem facing the country? Immediately after a terrorist attack, that goes up, and then it tends to come back down again. We do have another question that we have asked over the years. How concerned are you about the possibility of future terrorist attacks in the United States? That went up last year. We re-asked the question again this year, again prior to the most recent event in Belgium, and we found that it had stayed up pretty high. 48% of Americans say they worried a great deal about a terrorist attack in the U.S., and that was 51% last year, so it's really up there. It had been as low as just a third, 34%, if we go back to 2013. Dave, I have a question for you. What is it that Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders, strange bedfellows indeed, have in common?
Well, that they're all running for president, certainly, but I don't know.
They have all called in one way or the other for increased federal spending for infrastructure. That's perhaps not surprising from Sanders and Clinton. They're Democrats, more in favor of government spending in general. But Donald Trump has as well. We've all heard him talk about the deteriorating conditions he sees at LaGuardia Airport and so on and so forth. We asked the public about that, and what we found? Overwhelming support. And we phrased this, Dave. We said, spend more federal money. So we made it very clear to the public that this would cost, and it would be federal dollars, on the nation's infrastructure, bridges and highways and buildings and so forth. And it's very strong support. Almost 8 out of 10 Americans say yes to that proposition.
Though the perception, again, about Republicans that they are loath to increase taxes. Having said that, what is Trump's favorability rating with Republicans nationwide?
You know, you hear a lot of establishment Republicans saying we have to do something to keep him from getting the nomination. But when we look at the entire month of March to date, it's 55% favorable, 41% unfavorable among Republicans and Republican-leading independents. And remarkably, that's fairly stable. But I always like to put things in context. If you go back to previous nominees like George W. Bush in March of 2000, or Bob Dole in March of 1996, or you go back to John McCain in March of 2008, their favorability among Republicans was much higher. So Trump's clearly underperforming in his own party, with one exception, and that's Mitt Romney. In 2012, at about this point, Mitt Romney's image among Republicans was a little more, but not a lot more positive than Trump's is now. So Romney was in some trouble, although once he got the nomination, Romney's image became much more positive.
As always, for providing context, thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Still ahead this evening, the marriage of recordings and live concerts in the life of a modern musician.
The band improvises a lot, so the songs kind of expand and contract in a live setting. As far as the studio goes, it's kind of like you're creating an illusion. So what I try to do is actually capture that energy.
That's Chris Forsythe. Chris Forsythe and the Solar Motel Band have a new recording, and we'll check in as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Presidential candidates from both parties have criticized the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
We're not going to be able to change everybody's minds, and that's not our goal. It's not what's necessary.
I'm Molly Wood. Passing the TPP through Congress is an uphill battle. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Bryn Mawr Rehab supports WHYY and for more than 40 years has been committed to delivering advanced physical rehab services to those recovering from serious illness or injury. Their team of specialists develops customized inpatient and outpatient treatment plans for a range of conditions, including brain injury, spinal cord injury, concussion, and stroke. Patients travel from across the country for Bryn Mawr Rehab Hospital's creativity and personalized therapeutic approach. Learn more, including real patient stories, at mainlinehealth.org/rehab.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. This week, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf ended the impasse surrounding the long-overdue state budget for 2016. Wolf says he does not agree with terms of the budget, but rather than vetoing it, he'll let it become law without his signature. Wolf may place blame on Republicans for the delay, But NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones says neither side is innocent in this case.
While school districts across the Commonwealth were forced to borrow about $1 billion to survive the longest budget impasse in 60 years, Governor Tom Wolf told Pennsylvania taxpayers that he was holding out for a balanced budget. He couldn't hold out any longer. After a 266-day standoff with the Republican-led legislature, Wolf will allow a $30 billion GOP budget package to become law without his signature. It's a budget that Wolf warned would be a train wreck just days ago, and he says nothing has changed. The math in this budget does not work, Wolf said in a statement. Next fiscal year already has a $2 billion structural budget deficit that this budget does nothing to address, he said, while warning of credit downgrades, tax hikes, and other calamities. But if Wolf is right and nothing has changed, we've essentially waited 9 months for a budget that gave us no new sustainable revenues. We've waited 9 months to find out that Pennsylvania taxpayers will have to repay millions in interest on the loans that kept school districts afloat while state money was held up by petty politics. We've waited 9 months to find out we could be in a bigger mess than we were in when we started. Wolf blames Republican legislators who, he said, refused to bargain in good faith. Republicans, having gotten their way, are gleefully pointing the finger at Wolf. I blame both the governor and the Republican-led legislature for this mess. Governor Wolf, a businessman, clearly did not fully grasp the fine art of political compromise. And it didn't help that he publicly badmouthed the very people he needed to work with in order to make a deal. That combative style of leadership, along with the intransigence of Republican legislators, led to a 9-month budget stalemate. Along the way, Wolf, who'd repeatedly vetoed GOP budget proposals, offered a glimmer of hope by releasing 6 months' worth of emergency funds for schools and over $9 billion for human services. But after cracking open the door for compromise, Wolf slammed it shut during his second budget address in February when he wagged his finger at Republicans, saying in part, "If you won't take seriously your responsibility to the people of Pennsylvania, then find another job." House GOP leader Dave Reed didn't take kindly to the lecture, and in a reference to Peter Pan, said Wolf had left fantasy land for Neverland. We're talking about grown men here, people, and that's the shame of it all. Did Republicans play political games, signaling they would agree to a budget deal and then reneging? Yes, they did. Did Governor Wolf overestimate his negotiating position to the detriment of Pennsylvanians? Yes, he did. But despite all that, both sides now have a chance for a fresh start. With negotiations on the new budget just around the corner, neither the governor nor the Republican-led legislature can completely undo this year's huge fiscal mistakes. However, they can avoid repeating them. For the sake of all Pennsylvanians, I hope they choose the latter. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. That's a selection from The Rarity of Experience, a new album from Chris Forsythe and the Solar Motel Band. Joining me in studio is Chris Forsythe, band leader and guitarist. Chris, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Harmonious Dance is the name of that cut. Describe it and the sense of the entire album.
That song actually came from a dance piece that I did music for a number of years ago in New York with a choreographer named Miguel Gutierrez, and it was a kind of respite of beauty in the middle of a rather chaotic contemporary dance piece. And I've just sort of had it in my back pocket for a long time. The band recorded it for an album a couple years ago, and it didn't make the cut, but it always kind of was nagging at me, kind of like, this is, the song's got a hook, and band played it really well. So we did it for this album, and I think a kind of crucial cut on it.
So let's note, though, you cite New York, you're from New Jersey and now live in Philadelphia, as do presumably most of your bandmates.
Yeah, except for the bandmate who lives in New York who's from Philly. Peter Curlin is his name. And I had played music with him for many years when I lived in New York. And when I put the band together here, I called him up and said, you know, I'm putting together a band in Philly and I think I'm going to need to get some Philly people. And he said, well, you can't fire me. Like, I'm not, no, I'm coming down. Let's give it a few months and see if the commute can work. And it has. That was a few years ago.
Now, let's note that the record release, as it were, is tomorrow night at Philomoka.
Yeah.
Contrast live performance versus working in the studio.
Two totally different things. I like to work really spontaneously and quickly in either setting. I mean, the band improvises a lot, so the songs kind of expand and contract in a live setting. As far as the studio goes, it's kind of like you're creating an illusion. So what I try to do is actually capture that energy. Like we do the tracking real fast. Like, you know, we track this whole record in maybe 3 days. But then I sat with it and worked on it for like 10 or 12 months after that, you know, a little polishing here and a little addition there. You see what you've got from the improvisations and you can kind of build off those things. And then hopefully it still sounds kind of like an organic, coherent experience on the record as well as it does live. But, you know, you're going to hear it over and over and over again in a recording. And live, it just happens that one time.
I think improv. I think of jazz. I also think of what's to some as a pejorative, the jam band scene.
And sure.
This album seems to have aspects of both. Let's listen to another cut.
Sure.
This is a song whose title we can't really cite here on FM radio. However, it's from a Rolling Stones piece.
It's from a Rolling Stones song that was turned into a document, also the name of a documentary that was never released. If I'm in a situation where we can't speak freely, I usually refer to it as the title of that song is the first 10 minutes of the controversial Robert Frank documentary about the Rolling Stones' 1972 American tour.
Well, the song was AKA Schoolboy Blues, and then looking into it further, it's actually an intended ripoff of a Dr. John song from his seminal Babylon album.
Indeed.
There's a little bit of whimsy to it. It's called The First 10 Minutes Of, but actually the song, I believe, is 11 minutes, 53 seconds long.
Yeah, well, I originally did a solo version of this song, and it was really based sort of rhythmically and compositionally off the first 10 minutes of the film, CS Blues, we'll call it, because I love that film, and I would just often just sit around and sort of play along to it, and I realized it had this kind of loping rhythm that I really liked. So I did a solo piece of it, which was 10 minutes. But like I said, the music expands and contracts with the band, so it ended up being 12 on this version, yeah.
Let's go out then with another cover. Describe your interest in Richard Thompson in this specific piece.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's the best living guitar player, if you ask me, as well as a pretty handy songwriter and lyricist.
Going all the way back to, say, Fairport Convention
days? Yeah, sure. I mean, I love all of his stuff. And the stuff he did with his wife, then wife Linda Thompson in the 70s is probably my favorite. You know, and this song is great because on the studio, the recorded version that he did, it's really concise. It's like a 3-minute song. But live, he would really stretch it out. So we kind of based our version on one of these live versions that he would do with that were like, you know, 10 minutes long. And that also allowed us to kind of do our own thing with it, you know, like not to emulate it so much as to just sort of take the form and plug ourselves into it.
The album is called Rarity of Experience. Chris Forsythe and the Solar Motel Band will be performing a record release show tomorrow at Philomoka. Chris, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And so here's Calvary Cross. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas with production assistance from the intrepid Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.